You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with an author chat with Erin Baldwin to talk about her latest novel, Good Luck, Babe, a sapphic YA romance about two former best friends who have to fake a relationship to pursue their dream of going on the Adventureverse, which is a reality TV competition that they are both super fans of. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you gain access to our members-only Discord server. We can chat with us and fellow book club members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly Patron's Choice book club pick. As always, thanks to everyone who have supported us through our Patreon, and we love to see more of you there.
Yeah, so we talked to Erin about her long writing journey, from writing as a kid to now being a professional author. We talked to her about reality TV shows and the mind games that the production team plays, her love of Survivor, and just crafting a POV that's really authentic to her as someone who struggles with ADHD. So I hope you guys enjoy this talk with Erin. And we are here with Erin Baldwin, the author of Wish You Weren't Here, and most recently, Good Luck, Babe. And Erin is a Jersey City-based author, so thank you so much for taking the time to call us with the time zone difference. Welcome to the show, Erin.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
So since your most recent book, Good Luck, Babe, is set during a reality show, more specifically, an Amazing Race-esque show, I thought it would be prudent to ask you, what reality TV show do you think you would do well on?
Oh, Survivor. I would win Survivor if they would just cast me. They refuse to do it, though. They're cowards.
You've auditioned before.
7 years in a row, Rhea.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, I've made it to the second round of auditions a few times, but it's just not my time yet. Some people take a long time to get cast on Survivor. One day,
obviously they're scared of you. Like, they're like, if we put Erin Baldwin in, she would just like, there would be no contest, right?
That's what I'm saying. It's my ambition. It frightens them.
But I feel like to be on a show like Survivor, you do have to be kind of intimidating. You kind of have to like know your mettle, you know? So, I'm getting like a pretty good character sketch of you already.
Good. Perfect.
What about you, Marvin? If you could be on a reality show, like, what do you think you would do well on?
To be honest, I don't really like watch a ton of reality TV besides like cooking shows. And I'm not a good cook, so I don't think I would do well in those. Probably like a trivia show, right? Like, I think I would like... Mm. I don't know. I used to be really good with useless information, so Jeopardy would have been good. But I don't like, as I've gotten older, I feel like I've forgotten more than I ever knew. So I don't know. Or maybe Wheel of Fortune. I love word games. That might be fun.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. Assuming reality TV show includes game shows, which I don't know. It depends on your definition.
I'm going to count it.
Erin, I'm looking at your bio. Rhea,
what about you?
Oh,
you
can't I have skip. To. Oh, yeah. I have to reveal. Okay, so, I'm gonna be pretty honest. I am kind of bad at everything, so I don't think I could compete in like a competitive reality TV show. So it has to be something like Terrace House or like a show where you're just kind of going about your life and interacting with other people. So I don't know. Like,
yeah,
my favorite reality TV show right now is Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. And those are just like straight up insane people. I don't know if I can interact with that level of chaos every week in my life. So who knows? Yeah.
There's got to be some like trapped in a bookstore type of like reality TV show that you can join. I think that you would kill in that one.
A silent library or something.
Oh, I don't know what that is. So I mean, is it like be a monk for like a month?
No, very different. I think it started as like a Japanese game show, but it's like they have to do, I don't know, pranks and things in a library and they're not allowed to make any noise.
That's the one with the slap machine, right? Like they get hit by a slap machine. They can't make a sound.
Interesting. This sounds like my worst nightmare.
I would love to be on like one of those Asian style reality TV shows because those are just fun. You're just doing like dumb stuff. Like
ones where you have to like fit through a cutout in the wall.
Or oh my God, that's a classic. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Erin, I'm looking at your bio and it says that you started writing at 6 years old. So you've been writing for quite some time. Like, was it something that you kind of lost in touch with as you grew up? Or was it something that you were like very much like, I am going to be a writer and this is the only thing I'm going to do?
It's kind of neither. I was very practical about it from the time I was like a kid. Like this feels like something I'm making up, but it is true, is that when I was young and I really got into writing for the first time and really like knew that I loved it, I would spend all my free time writing. I remember one time being at my grandma's house and she was like, Erin, what do you want to do when you grow up? You know, trying to make conversation with that child. And I was like, well, I'd love to be an author, but only like 1% of people who want to be authors actually get to be authors. So I guess I'm not going to do that. Like, I remember saying that exact thing to my grandma. I was wrong. So that's cool.
Wait, so do you remember what your grandma said? Like, did she praise you for being pragmatic or did she like feel sad that you're like limiting your dreams already as a child?
I don't really remember, but if I had to guess, she probably laughed at me. She was probably like, what are you talking about? Like, because like, just imagine a 6-year-old telling you statistics about a career prospect. Like, you'd just be like, who are you? What's happening? You know? I imagine that's the reaction she had.
Yeah.
I think you were like, at least you knew that it was a job that was very difficult to get. It's not just like a magical position. Because there are a lot of authors that we've talked to who are just like, I didn't know writing was a job. I didn't know like writing books was even like a thing that you could get paid for. So you need the business from a very young age. Yeah.
I think I got like when my family realized I was into writing, I don't know exactly how I acquired this book, but I was given like a writing workbook type thing by the author of Ella Enchanted, Gail Carson Levine.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. I love her. She's my childhood hero. Yes.
Yes, me too. I love her. And she I love Two Princesses of Bamar. I've probably read that book 100 times.
Oh my God, me too. Such an such like, wow. I have not heard that title in so long because I feel like people mention Ella Enchanted as like the one book that Gail Levine Carson has like written. And I'm like, no, like some of her original stuff is like better.
So good. Yes. But she had like a writing book for kids, like how to write. Here are some prompts for stories. And I think that piece of information, that statistic, might have come from that book or somehow related to that book. So I think without that, I probably would have had a very delusional belief about writing as a career. But Gail Carson Levine taught me young.
So can you talk to us about how you came back to like pursuing that dream? Like when was it, or what was it that like caused you to say, hey, you know what? I can write a novel and I will write a novel and get published. Like, what was that like?
I wrote a lot until I got into high school. And you know, sorry if my cat is meowing in the mic.
Oh my goodness. introduce us to your cats.
I have two cats. One is the baby boy and the other is the baby girl. This one's the baby girl yelling. They're best friends. They're orange cats, and they spend all of their time snuggling each other. They're so cute.
Oh my God, those names are perfect for orange cats, by the way. Uh-huh. Baby girl, baby boy.
When I first got them, I wasn't sure about what to name them, and I wanted to make sure I picked something that was like perfect. And then I kind of just got stuck with this because this is what I was calling them, and now they respond to it. So,
yeah. Got to be honest, when your cats were crying out, I thought it was my, like, I have twin toddlers upstairs, oh. Also a baby boy and a baby girl. And I honestly thought one of them fell and were crying. So I was like, do I need to rush up there? Do I need to rush upstairs?
I hope yours have real names, though.
They do. They do. Eventually, yeah. When they first came out, they were boy A and girl B for like the first 3 days till we figured out their names. But eventually,
well, it's good. Names, a little yeah. placeholder.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing, Erin, like, so your debut novel was Wish You Weren't Here, but since you've been writing for so long, you must have written other manuscripts before you started, like, querying for real and getting representation, right?
Yes. Sorry. I think that's what I was saying before. I was interrupted by this creature. So I was really into writing, got into high school, got a life, and then kind of fell off. And then when I my degree and my career are in nursing. And when I was like finishing up college, I kind of just, I don't know, something about it just like called back out to me. I had always been thinking about writing and sort of practice for my life now. Felt really guilty all the time for not writing. Like all throughout those years I wasn't writing, I would just be thinking like, oh, I should be writing right now. I should be writing a book right now. And then, you know, didn't do it. But as I was leaving college, I got this idea that really like captured my interest. And that I had written like partial manuscripts before, like the kinds of stories that like teenagers write or like kids write, you know. Like the first real long story I wrote was like an Alice in Wonderland retelling with assassins, you know, like that type of thing. But then at the end of college, I had this idea for a dark fantasy, like political thriller set in Chicago with like magicians trying to overthrow the government. And that was the first book that I ever queried and died in the query trenches. And my dream agent, who is now my real agent, Lauren Spieler, she had requested a partial. So she had requested the first 50 pages. And then she replied to me like, this is good. The writing is good. This is a solid story. It's not going to stand out on the shelf. So like you need to, there's fantasy is a crowded space and you need to pivot and do something else. And I, after that, I had been querying for 2 years and I was just like, it was so disheartening. And so I kind of like gave up for 2 years and I was like, fine, then I won't write. And then during COVID, I was obviously working in nursing and I was in the hospitals and travel nursing around the country. And I was just feeling really like I was having a very different experience from everybody else because everyone else was on lockdown. All of their jobs had stopped, all of that stuff. But nothing about my job changed. Like I was still going to work every day. I was still like, I wasn't quarantining in my house because I was taking care of COVID patients, you know? And I was feeling like I was living in a completely different world from people. And the world that I was living in really, I mean, the world we're all living in, but my world felt in particular, like it really sucked. Like I was doing CPR on like 20-year-olds. I was dealing with these patients who were in the hospital with COVID who were COVID deniers and stuff. And I was like, I just want there to be like a fun, fluffy piece of media that reminds me of why life is good. And so I wrote it with Wish You Weren't Here, which like I worked at camp when I was in college and it was just a really joyful time of my life. And capturing that was really fun. And it was also partially encouraged by Lauren's advice to pivot out of dark fantasy. So I was like, let me get into sapphic romance. That is a not crowded market.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, thank you for, you know, everything you did during that really tough time. You know, like Rira and I, we were just stuck at home, but you were there in the trenches. So I can't imagine that was like very intense.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. I think it's really ever since the lockdown, we've interviewed authors who, you know, they're like, oh, I had a lot of free time on my hand because I was stuck at home. So I decided to write a book. Whereas with you, it's like I had to go to work every single day and I had to find the time and energy to write a book. And I was like, oh, very like opposite sides of the spectrum during this writing
very
experience.
Very weird, like it's because everybody else had the opposite experience except for people who are working in hospitals or like working, I guess, like some essential food places and stuff like that. But I remember being really jealous of everybody who got to stay home. I was like, I want to stay home. Like everyone else just gets to stay home and they hate it because everyone was cooped up, you know, but to have to continue working and like doing stuff for all those months and everybody else just got to have a little vacation. I was like, what the heck? But it's fine. It's fine. When I talk about it, it sounds a lot more dramatic than it was at the moment. It was really just me going to work every day.
I mean, it's, I think that time period really, I say time period as if, this was like a decade ago, but I guess it was like half a decade ago at this point. It's just, I feel like it was just a really hard transitional time for everyone figuring out like how we just like navigate unknown, uncharted waters. So I guess it was like a time where everybody kind of had permission to be brave and to do something reckless.
And to start new hobbies.
Yeah, and to start new hobbies. And a lot of those hobbies were writing books. So, So like Wish You Weren't Here was your first published novel, and now your novel Good Luck Babe, which we're going to be talking about more of later in this episode, that's your sophomore book. Mm-hmm. Now, in the publishing industry, there's something called a sophomore slump, a sophomore novel, because it's so different from writing your debut novel because there's like much more pressure. You don't have like the freshness of like a debut author anymore. I'm curious, like how is your writing and publishing experience like different from Wish You Weren't Here for this book this time around?
It's an interesting question. And you'll see the pretzels I twist myself in to convince myself that it's fine that I didn't get on a bestseller list for my first book. Because I think to myself, like, a lot of people do experience that pressure of, like, is my book going to perform as well as my first book did? Like, my first book was a New York Times bestseller. Is this one also going to, whatever, am I going to be a one-hit wonder? I don't have that problem. My first book sold well and still sells well. But not having that pressure, I think, really created a different experience for me than somebody who maybe wrote a quarantine novel. And it was the first real like book that they wrote and like took seriously. And then now they have to write a second book and their first book succeeded. And this is a new hobby for them, right? But for me, it's a long hobby. I've been doing a long time. I've already had a book fail in the query trenches, right? I've already written a ton. And so I did have difficulty writing Good Luck Babe, but it was more wrestling with the story and not with like the expectations that were on me for it being my sophomore novel. I actually wanted to make my bio on the back cover of this book. Erin Baldwin doesn't believe in sophomore slumps, but my editor was like, Erin, you can't do that.
She's like, don't jinx yourself. Don't make the other authors feel feel bad if they're going through sophomore
and you're
going
to feel
right
real
now.
Foolish when you don't hit a bestseller list, which I didn't. So she was right.
So for Good Luck Babe, a lot of our listeners, like, they might not have heard about your book. So if you can give us like a short elevator pitch, that would be lovely.
Sure. So Good Luck Babe is the story of two former best friends and reality TV super fans who film an audition for their favorite Race Around the World reality TV show. So it's basically The Amazing Race. And then they have a falling out. And they don't talk for a year, and they are reunited by the call asking them to fill a last minute spot on The Amazing Race. And then hijinks ensue.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you, why did you choose Amazing Race instead of like another reality TV show? You mentioned that you auditioned for Survivor, so I'm guessing that, you know, you could have easily written a Survivor sapphic romance novel.
Yes, and I toyed with it for a while, but it's just not as interesting, like, conceptually. It's so much more visually stimulating for the problems to come from the characters when they are not starving on an island. You know what I mean? Because if you're trying to conceive of like a romance between two people who have a long history, and you put them in a high pressure situation that also deprives them of food or exposes them to the elements or whatever, I think it kind of brings up the question, how much of this is real and how much of this is trauma bonding? Or at least in my mind, it did. And just also, like, visually, it's so much more fun to watch people go on like a globe-trotting adventure than to read about people like sitting in sand for 98% of the book. So, and then my Survivor fan brain was like, well, they've done Blood versus Water seasons before, and they don't let the tribes, like, they don't let the pairs be on the same tribe, so it doesn't make sense because they'd be split up into two different tribes. It's just, I'm too close to Survivor to be able to change any of the details.
You have to have that room of fantasy, pretty much the freedom to like make things up. Whereas like with Survivor, you're like, I know the inside baseball. Like I know
exactly
how things work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm like, Jeff would never allow this.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talked about your background in writing dark fantasy, because like as I was reading the book, like, so, you know, the short answer to this question might just be it's just based on Amazing Race, but like I've never watched Amazing Race. So like this is all new to me, but like, you know, not only did you create your own reality TV series for this novel, you also created a history for it, right? You created previous seasons, established tropes. And I'm just wondering, like, how much of that, like, world-building skills that you built up writing fantasy did you use to kind of, like, create, like, this timeline of the show that's been long-running in the world of your novel?
Oh, that's an interesting question. It was world-building when I really think about it, but not necessarily from my fantasy days, more from my listening to podcasts while doing dishes days. So I listened to a lot of Survivor podcasts, and a lot of the details from this are kind of drawn from the way that I interact with things that I really like. This keeps coming up recently. It's something I really value in storytelling, and I always have valued, is when the writer can bring you along to something that you wouldn't have necessarily even cared about otherwise. And when they can teach you something. Like, whenever I read a book as a kid, I remember there was like a book that I read. I don't even remember the title of it, but it's about a boy who goes to a nursing home to visit his grandma a lot. I don't remember what the actual plot of the book was, but the part of the book was that he learns to play bridge, and he spends a lot of the book playing bridge with his grandma and the other old ladies in the nursing home. And I learned how to play bridge from that book. And that always like sticks out to me as like anytime I learn something weird from a book, it always stuck with me as a kid. And I just really enjoyed that. And it's how I interact with things that I love in real life. I will talk incessantly at people about things that I love and explaining the history of them. And if I'm watching Survivor with someone for the first time, I'll be like, okay, so typically this is what will happen. And then, oh, the reason that they're saying this is because four seasons ago, this happened. And whenever I would read a book about reality TV, they never did that. Like it was usually a bachelor or a bachelorette type story. And they didn't interact with the fact that the show already existed. They interacted with the show as if it was like the first season and nobody knew anything about the history. And everyone was completely surprised when they made the people who are afraid of heights get in a helicopter. And like, they just, it was, I don't know, reading stuff like that as a reality TV fan, I was like, this isn't how so many people I know love these shows that have long history. Survivor's been on for 26 years. It has like 50 something seasons. And I just was like, I wanted to bring that world building to this story. And also it's an excuse to talk about the things I like, which I like to do. So
I have to say, you did a really good job depicting like the logistics and the psychological mind games the production team of a reality TV show would do. Like, I know that there are some reality TV shows where they pit the PAs against each other because they get like paid based on like how much screen time their charge gets. So
yeah,
there's a lot of like mind games outside of the cast as well. And I just like really enjoyed, as someone who went to film school and also like interned for reality TV stuff. I was just like, oh, she got like some of the tricks right, where like you trick your audience into thinking that like this was shot on the same day or like in the same location, but it's just like, no, this was shot like the day after. Everybody had like, everybody chilled at their hotel and it was like another day. And
exactly. A Frankenbite.
Like, how much research did you do on like the production side of the reality show filmmaking, or is that just something that you've acquired from watching reality TV shows for all these years?
You're starting to understand me, Rira. It is something I acquired
from
watching reality TV shows. I just think, especially because I was auditioning to be on these shows, I was engaging with them as somebody who wanted to be on them. So the stuff that I would learn wasn't stuff that like somebody who was watching as just like a viewer would learn. It's somebody who wants to be on the show and then use those tricks to make. So for example, there's a survivor who found idols. So in Survivor, you get voted off the island, right? And they have immunity idols. And if you have one and you play it correctly, you can negate votes against you and not get voted off, right? And there was one contestant who kind of played production. He would go hunting for idols. And when he would get to a spot where more cameramen would show up, he'd know there was an idol around there somewhere and they were all showing up for in case he found it, you know, so they could get different angles. So he would kind of like use that to triangulate the location of idols. Or people who will say to the production team, like they'll hint at who they're going to vote home, like in the interview, because production already knows, right? They see you talking. But in the confessional, they'll say like, oh, I'm thinking about voting off this person. And whoever production kind of latches onto, they'll know that that person has an idol. And if they try to vote them home, that person's gonna stay, right? So I wanted to learn all those tricks so that I could win Survivor. And then using, like, incorporating them into the book was just kind of the next logical step.
Yeah, I do love how Noelle and Yumi are you know, they auditioned for Adventureverse because they're super fans and they, you know, that's their archetype in the in this season. They are the super fans and they are the team to beat because they know all the tricks. But I also thought it was really funny that you had archetypes for the other contestants as well.
Yes.
Was there like a team other than Yumi and Noelle that you like really enjoyed writing?
Yes, I loved writing Matt and Morgan, the dancers. So their archetype is Grumpy Sunshine. And they were really fun to write. There were a lot more scenes with them that I ended up cutting out just for space. But they were really enjoyable. It's always fun to write like a grumpy guy who only melts for one person, you know, and then freezes back up into an iceberg the second another person talks to him. That's enjoyable. And I really liked the football, retired football players. Those are my two favorites.
Yeah, like one of the retired football players, there's a scene where, I mean, I don't think this is really much of a spoiler, but there's a scene where the contestants are at the airport and Noelle finds out that one of the footballers, he has a prosthetic leg because he had a traumatic injury during a game. And she is very aware that the camera can like make her look ableist. So she's like, how do I get out of this situation so I don't look bad? And then she mentions that her father, Papa Breland, is having a liver failure and he's like not doing well. And that's kind of the motivation for her being on the show without like mentioning that's specifically the reason why she wants to be on the show, because that's like a big taboo when it comes to reality TV shows. And I just thought that this level of just like just being self-aware and like learning how to anticipate what social media will crucify you for was just so interesting, because I don't really see that in a lot of reality TV show based books, because we've seen like Bachelorette, Love Island type of storylines in YA romance, but yeah, this was a little bit different. So I want to hear like your perspective on like writing scenes like that.
Yeah, again, I think it's all because I want to be on those shows, right? So it's something I think about. But I think all of us, like you guys too, right, as podcasters, you probably are aware as you're talking of what can be taken out of context and what you can say that might be like, if somebody heard it, just that clip, they'd be like, oh, what is this podcast about? Like, what are they saying? Right. Even if the thing you're saying is innocuous, as you're editing and stuff, you're probably like, oh, I should, you know, cut that out or whatever. And I think everybody is, because of how on social media we are and how strong cancel culture is, especially like the younger kids, right? Like Gen Z, I think, are very careful. They don't have any personal posts on their Instagrams, you know. They don't post anything about their lives online. That was always really interesting to me, that this is a way that we all interact with the world, in being really careful what we say online or when we're being filmed or whatever. But fiction hadn't quite caught up to that yet, because it's been that way for a while. But in reality TV books, the characters are never thinking about it. And I just thought that was really interesting. It feels very like anachronistic to think that people could go on TV and then not think about how they're going to be perceived by the audience, because the audience perceiving you is the whole thing, right? Like that's, you'll have to deal with that for the rest of your life. People are going to be so annoying about whatever you did on reality TV, right? So I think came naturally to me that is how you would interact with a show that you were on and you knew was going to be nationally broadcast.
Yeah, I definitely feel like some of the books that we read have like an idealized version of, like, it's like reality TV the way that we imagine it should be as a viewer. But the truth is, like, especially with like this industry being so mature at this point, people are joining with like specific objectives, right? You have certain people going, expecting to be like wanting to be the villain so they can get the screen time, get the followers, and get the notoriety. You have people going and just like, yeah, like you said, understanding that the nothing should be taken at face value, right? Everything is like, mm-hmm. it's a show. You have producers that are like pursuing storylines, trying to fit you into certain boxes or trying to get certain reactions out of you because that's what the viewers wanted. The viewers crave, you know, depending on the type of show it is, the viewers crave drama. They crave emotion, right? And yeah, I think it's, you know, again, very pragmatic view, but I feel like a lot of people going into, like, I don't think anyone joining a reality TV show like Survivor, like Amazing Race, are going without like that sort of pragmatic mindset, right? Otherwise, you can get destroyed by the producers.
Right, exactly. Or like, it's so funny because like, I think you're right that it's an idealized version of reality. But like, if you really thought about it, the people going on Love Island aren't going there thinking that they're going to meet someone they're going to marry. They're going there so that they become Instagram famous, right? Like, nobody is like, oh my God, I can't wait to meet my husband on Love Island. You know, that's not why they're there. But we as the viewer pretend. Are you familiar with the term kayfabe?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a kayfabe.
It's wrestling term, right?
Yes, oh, yes.
Okay.
It's that you buy, like wrestling fans pretend to buy into the fact that wrestling is real. Everybody knows it's fake. The wrestlers know it's fake. The fans know it's fake. People outside of the community know it's fake. It's just a choreographed act. And everything that they do and say is also choreographed. But the viewers pretend that they believe it. And that's part of the fun of the thing. It's the same with reality TV. The viewers pretend that they believe that the people on The Bachelor care about falling in love with the people on The Bachelor, you know? And it's just, it's so weird and meta. It's so many levels of people like pretending things.
I gotta say, so I watched The Bachelorette for the first time because, you know, we had an Asian Bachelorette. So I was like, I'm mm-hmm. obligated as an Asian American pop culture person to like watch this. And I gotta say, I could not keep the kayfabe going. I was like, this show is not working for me.
But they really want you to. They talk about not being there for the right reasons. It's like, nobody's there for whatever reason you guys are presenting to us.
Yeah.
It's all publicity. Everybody has their exactly. own agendas. And, you know, that makes it like a great setting for a fake relationship story because Noelle and Yumi, like the reason why they're casted and it's last minute, they're like a replacement for a different couple that broke up. They're like, okay, they think that we're a sapphic couple. Like, we both really love this show. We followed it for years. This is our chance. I guess we fake it till we make it. But they're also like super aware. They're like, the viewers aren't stupid. Mm-hmm. They'll catch. they'll know, like, the second, like, especially the producers, they'll know when something is up, if we're making things up. So we have to like base some of our farce on the reality of our relationship, which is that they've been friends for a very long time. So how is that? Can you like talk us through like how you wrote that relationship? Like, why did you decide to, for example, write Noelle and Yumi's story 1 year after their friendship kind of split?
I originally wasn't going to. I was going to have it be two friends who just go on and then fall in love. And it just didn't feel like there was enough meat there, you know, because like I call this book and Penguin calls this book, right, a rom-com, but it's really more of like a coming of age. And to give Noelle and Yumi some more attention, something had to happen, right? And I've always loved there's just something so like delicious about how sad it is when you are away from somebody, even not like in a romantic way, but if you're away from someone for a really long time and estranged for whatever reason, and then you re-enter their life and something has happened that you can't have ever been there for, right? Like if somebody's family member dies or someone's dog passes away or whatever. Like, and the moment where you're like, oh, how's your dog? And they're like, oh, sorry, he passed away like 2 years ago. Like, it, that is always sad, really sad to me, that that's like just time that you can't get back. And I thought that that would be a really, like, really fertile ground for two people being forced into close proximity after Yumi isn't there when Noelle's dad is diagnosed with liver failure. And she keeps picturing, like, Noelle being in the emergency room by herself, Noelle sitting in the hallway by herself, not having anybody to call and all this stuff. And, like, it just felt like it added another layer of dimension and interest to their relationship and made it more nuanced to balance out how heavily nuanced the Adventureverse was, right? Because this wasn't just a book about the Adventureverse and then two people on it, right? I wanted to make that those scales a little bit more even.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was also interesting that, you know, your main character, Noelle, is also, like, diagnosed with ADHD, and a lot of her struggles throughout the novel comes from her, like, you know, wrestling with, like, how her mind works and how, you know, without Yumi for the past year, she also was spiraling. And I thought it was really worked to, like, put a lot of the rom-com tropes into context. Like, a lot of times when we're reading rom-coms, like, the biggest emotion that I get is, like, why is this person making just all the wrong decisions? Why are they this way? And with the context of, like, yeah, like, because she is, you know, she can't focus, she's spiraling. She, you know, she also is always picturing the worst possible outcome for mm-hmm. everything. Like, it kind of puts the incredulity I have with, like, rom-com protagonists into context. I thought it really worked within the book. And, you know, if you think about a lot of rom-com heroes and heroines, they're probably, like, undiagnosed, right? That's why they, like, make bad
people always joke
all the time
that Mr. Darcy is, like, autistic. Uh-huh. At least, like, in the 2005 film version, I think he's just a proud guy if you read the original. And, like, yeah, I do love how you wrote Noelle having ADHD, because you know, you're reading it in first person and you're seeing how these spirals start to begin. And I just love how, like, in the middle of her spiral, it'll be like a random joke or like a random observation. Mm-hmm. And she's like, OK, I'm good. And I'm like, wow, that is like, I feel like that is something that a lot of neurotypical people might be, like, unaware of it being, like, a strategy to stop spiraling. And I think you did that really well. Can you, like, talk about, like, are you diagnosed with ADHD? Like, do you know someone who is diagnosed with ADHD? Like, how did you get those aspects right?
I think that we have been on this call for, like, 50 minutes, and you guys probably could diagnose me with ADHD, like, just the two of you from this conversation. Yeah, I was diagnosed with ADHD later in life, surprisingly, because I just to go off on a tiny little tangent, I always think about this, like, when you are a kid who is struggling in any way, right? As long as you are doing well in school, that struggle always, like, slips through the cracks, right? Like, I had ADHD as a kid and I would have very much benefited from coping techniques or medication or whatever. But I was really good at school and I was, like, a smart kid. And so everybody was like, oh, she's fine, you know? And then once I must have been, like, 22 or something, maybe later, my younger sister was diagnosed and she came up to me and she's like, Erin, I think you should get tested for ADHD. And I was like, no. And she was like, you're not in school anymore. Like, just think about the way you think. Like, you have nothing to measure yourself against anymore. Like, I can't just be like, oh, I'm getting haze, I'm fine. She's like, you are so scattered. You guys heard me searching for my microphone. I was, like, dumping over the trash bin trying to find my microphone. I'm, like, so disorganized. And she was just like, Erin, you need to go see a psychiatrist. And I was already seeing one for other treatment. And I was like, my sister thinks I have ADHD. And my psychiatrist was like, oh, have I not already told you that you have ADHD?
It's like, oh, you didn't know?
So then we started Adderall and now life is good. But yes, it's I remember reading for the first time somebody in a book having time blindness, which is a controversial topic, you know, but a frequent symptom of ADHD, not being able to losing track of time very quickly. And it was somebody who was out to a lunch break at work, and they like look up and suddenly they are late to get back to work and feeling just like really bad about it and just being like, it really sucks to be late all the time and I feel bad about it every time. And like, I acknowledge that other people's time is valuable and it is disrespectful for me to not show up on time, right? But it is something I physically can't do. I like mentally am not like able to do it. And it was the first time that I was like, oh, that is somebody talking about ADHD in a way that felt very true and also very different from how people usually talk about it. And I, as I was writing this book, found my, I didn't do it on purpose at first, but there's a scene in the beginning where Noelle is talking to Yumi and Noelle is feeling, they're trying to decide if they want to go on the show. And Noelle is feeling very anxious and they're outside by a stone bench and Noelle has crouched beside the bench or like at the end of the bench and she's grabbing the sides of the bench and rocking back and forth like with her weight, like leaning forward onto the bench and leaning all the way back and leaning forward. And I wrote that scene because I was like, okay, well, obviously this is what she would do here. Like, this is how somebody processes this moment. And as I was reading it back, I was like, oh, Noelle is like neurodivergent. She's like very neurodivergent. It just made sense to me that she would do those things. And then I was like, well, if I'm going to have it in the book, I might as well, you know, talk about it and kind of see if I could capture that moment, that same moment that I had with the time blindness with ADHD and specifically dissociation.
Yeah, I think you wrote those symptoms really well. I'm not diagnosed with ADHD, but I have friends who are, and they do struggle with time loss and also just like executive dysfunction. It doesn't mean that they're, you know, not trying, but, you know, like it is just something that they have to grapple with every day. And I just like love the relationship you wrote between Noelle and Yumi, because Yumi's just like, I'll be your executive assistant. Mm-hmm. I'll be on top of it so that you don't have to worry so much about like forgetting things or being not on time. And I was just thinking about like how Amazing Race, the version on your in your book, like they have these challenges. And obviously they're going to pick challenges. They're going to like interview you and say, what are you most scared of? What is something that like you never thought you would do? And for Yumi, it's heights. Like she hates heights. Any of the challenges that have heights, she's like, I don't want to do it. But for Noelle, as someone with ADHD, the challenges are very different for her. Can you talk a little bit about that, like crafting the challenges for Noelle in your Amazing Race verse?
Yes. So I think it's really easy for somebody to look at something like being afraid of the dark or being afraid of heights and seeing how a producer could build a nightmare for that person, right? But I obviously want to go on reality TV, and I don't think I could do The Amazing Race because I am so fearful of being humiliated on TV, and that's kind of the bread and butter of The Amazing Race. They're going to make you look stupid. They are going to put you in like a chicken hat and make you do like a dance in like a town square and like make like panhandle for money. Like they're putting you in these situations that are just kind of really embarrassing inherently. And that is my nightmare. Like that is the thing that I would feel the most affected by and like most afraid to do. And when I was thinking about that, I was like, well, there are so many other psychological you know, things going on other than just like a fear of heights, a fear of swimming, a fear of the dark, that you can really mess with somebody if you were a producer trying to create drama, right? So Noelle, being a very impatient person, is often made to do these tedious tasks that require a lot of patience or require a lot of attention to detail, something that she just mentally cannot do. She cannot hold all of these things in her head at the same time or like be okay with searching for something for hours or whatever. And I think that's even more interesting than like being afraid of heights in this context, because like that's expected, but you don't expect someone to like delve into your brain and figure out like exactly how to psychologically manipulate you, you know? And yet they've done it. They did it with Noelle.
Like, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but there, one of the challenges is her just searching for something on the beach, and her mind is just like, did I look at that already? Like, what if I didn't look at it close enough? What if I missed something? Did I go over to that area before? And I was like, oh my God, this challenge is absolutely tailored to her ADHD. And like, it is just like a personal hell that was like really creatively crafted into a challenge. And I'm curious, like, how did you come up with the riddles for the challenges in the book? And also like the locations. I know that you travel a lot. Like, were the cities that you picked for the contest in your book like cities that you've actually visited?
No, that would have been very smart of me to do. I didn't do that. I was like, I'm going to pick the coolest places. And then I have such a mental commitment to not misrepresenting something. I spent so many hours walking the streets of like Croatia, of like there's a part where they're like in this volcano in Iceland, and the volcano itself is off like a barren stretch of road. And I was walking up and down that road in Google Maps for hours trying to like figure out exactly where they would turn, because I didn't want somebody to read it and then be like, oh, well, Aaron says that they made a right, but you would actually make a left there if you were there in real life, which is crazy and nobody cares about that. But I was like, I have to get this perfect. It would have been a lot easier for me to choose somewhere that I had been. And perhaps if I could go back in time, I would do that. But I've learned a lot about some cool places, so at least that's good.
That's interesting, because in your author acknowledgments at the end, you mentioned that you've, these are your words, murdered a serial killer's worth of darlings in the process, yes, of writing this book. And you know, one of them was like challenges in the Philippines, which, you know, as mm-hmm. someone who has a Asian American book club, I was sad to see that wasn't in the book. But can you talk a little bit about like just the process of killing your darlings, and like, you know, you obviously put a lot of thought into everything you write, and like, how was that experience of like deciding what you should take out to like make the book like more, I guess, readable or better, like tighter story?
There right now is a kind of push in fiction to make books as short as possible, both because people's attention spans are getting shorter, and because it's expensive to print books. And so publishers are like, hey, cut this down. So I wanted to tighten the book and make it a book that you could fly through, right? But also there was like, I needed to get it below a certain word limit. And at one point, the book was dual POV. There were Yumi chapters from Yumi's perspective. It's such a bummer. One of the reasons that I had to cut the Philippines was because that section was told from Yumi's POV. And it was sort of like this. So they ride on a jeepney, which is like this bus converted from like World War II jeeps that were left behind by US soldiers. But now they're kind of public transportation. And there's this thing that people do. They'll just sit on top of them and hold on to like these like grab bars. And then the like bus driver will drive around and you're just on top of this moving vehicle. It is not safe. And Yumi and Noelle are taking a jeepney through like a jungle, like a forest area. And they're sitting on top of it. And it's the first time that Yumi has gotten to do this, because every time she's come to the Philippines, her parents have been like, you can't do that. You'll die. Like, we're not going to let you ride on top of a bus. What are you talking about? And now they're not there. And she's kind of having this experience of coming back to a place where she's been. And she considers, you know, kind of home. She didn't grow up there, but she went there a lot. And what it feels like to come back to a place and experience it as a different person in a different context. So Yumi speaks Tagalog, but the place that they go, Buscalan, is they don't speak Tagalog. They speak a different regional dialect. And so Yumi is excited to hear they're going to the Philippines, because she's like, oh, I can speak Tagalog, even though a lot of people there speak English. She's like, oh, I can speak Tagalog, that'll help. And then she finds out they're going to a place where they don't speak Tagalog, right? And it's just like, she keeps having these experiences where she's experiencing the Philippines, but as an outsider. And once I cut Yumi's POV, it was like, I can't keep these chapters because they're so intrinsically told from Yumi's perspective. Noelle can't have that same. She can be riding on top of the jeepney, but all of the narrative about what it feels like and how it compares to when she was a kid and blah, 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 like would have to go, and I'd have to come up with something else to fill that space. And it just didn't feel like it was worth it to do that, to present a worse version of that, of those scenes, you know. It was a bummer.
Yeah. I mean, it was the right decision, but also I'm also sad that you had to make that decision.
I know. Ugh, sad to see them go. Really, some really good scenes. They got to the world's oldest tattoo artist. They went to her village and Yumi learned how to do her signature tattoo, which is three dots in a row, with a sort of like stick and poke type technique with like a little hammer thing. And it was really fun to write that. And it's you know, it's for the greater good of the book, but it is sad when you see something like that, that like means a lot to you, like, when you have to leave it behind.
Yeah.
But it was all for the greater good. I think your editor made the right call to make it a solo narrative perspective, because mm-hmm. I feel like with Noelle and her ADHD and her tendency to kind of like have time blindness and also like forget things, even like forget things that happened to her and things that she said herself, I'm like, oh, she's mm-hmm. kind of an unreliable narrator, so it makes like the yearning work more in the favor of the story. Whereas like if you had Yumi's POV, I'm sure it would have been like, it's like, why, it's like, I'm cool, why is she being so weird? Or
yeah,
like
exactly.
I feel like it wouldn't bring as much tension, but I hope you have saved those scenes and like have them in your hard drive somewhere, because
yes, I have them on my website.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I was looking at your website, and I think this is a good way to wrap up our chat. But yeah, like your website's really cool.
Thank you.
I'm looking at your section that says works in progress, and you have so many projects on here that are in like different stages. Like, can you like talk to us about why you decided to put this on your website? Because usually people keep their works in progress close to their chest and like not release it out into the world until it's complete.
Yes, I don't believe in this sounds crazy. I do believe in plagiarism. I don't believe that you can steal an idea from somebody. Like, some people will be like, oh, these two people wrote a time loop romance at the same time, like one of them must have stolen it from the other. I don't believe in that. And also, I have a lot of confidence in my writing and my voice and my style. I'm very lucky to be like one of like three people in the world who don't suffer from imposter syndrome in writing. Like I, cause I've been doing it for so long and, I know that I can do it. You know, I've done it before. I'll do it again. And I have a million ideas a day. So for me to like put these out there is a lot, is exciting because I get to share these like weird ideas with people, right? And because I have ADHD, I'm probably not going to write them anyway. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to finish these ideas. So it's fun to be able to be like, hey, here's a cool idea I have. And then if somebody, if they really resonate with an editor or somebody and they're like, hey, I think you should pursue this idea, then that's a sign for me to pursue it. But otherwise, it's just here because I, it's fun to share the idea and I'm not worried about people stealing them because I'll have more. And nobody would write that idea the same way that I would write it anyway. So it doesn't matter, you know? I don't feel precious about my ideas in the way that I think some people are afraid that their idea will get stolen. I really do believe that like a rising tide lifts all ships. So if somebody steals my idea and they're really successful, great, because then I'll do my idea and then I'll be, I can ride the wave of their success also. So it's good.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, that's the whole reason why the publishing industry has like the comp titles, right? It's like, oh, this book meets this show and this other show. Like, if you like those two things, then you'll definitely like this. It's like you said, all tides, right? Like you will benefit from, someone writing a similar story to yours, because in the end people just want more stories.
That's right.
And,
it's, that's
yeah, exactly. And I do love that you have created this space on your website to like not even just like share works in progress, but also like stuff you couldn't include in your book. It's almost like creating fan fiction or your own IP.
yeah exactly. Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what Stephanie Meyer has done with like Midnight Sun or whatever. With
the, yes, the host or whatever.
Yeah. She did like an Edwards POV short story that was like on her website for a long time. And then it finally got published. And then she did a gender bent version, which was also kind of like only accessible online for a really long time before they printed it out. So I think you are right about how publishers, they do seek shorter stories these days because of paper shortage, because of attention span. But I think in terms of like fandoms, I think readers do crave that extra space to fantasize and play and to come up with their own like episodes and stories. So it's really cool that you as an author are just like, I'm just going to create my own episodes and create my own spinoffs.
Yes. Yes, I think that this is something that a place where self-published fiction really succeeds is one that, like, if you just look at the self-publishing industry, they are the perfect example of you can't steal an idea. There are so many self-published books that are girl who went to high school with this guy who now is a famous hockey player, billionaire, ends up working as his assistant, and then they fall in love.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's just this, but they people eat it up every time because people want more of the things that they love. But for some reason, traditional publishing, like publishers, they don't see that. They only see like competition for market space. But we see it happening in real time where Heated Rivalry doesn't make people not want to read hockey romances. All the other hockey romances are succeeding now, you know? And I think there's this quote by Flannery O'Connor that I always come back to with my work. And it's a good idea resists summation and expands in the mind. And I always know that an idea is good when it's expanding in people's minds, right? If I tell people about an idea that I have and then they come back to me hours later and they're like, hey, but what if you did this? Or like, what about if this happened? Or what if you added this type of character? It's expanding in the mind, you know? And I think that we could use more of that in traditional publishing, just letting things expand in the mind. And it's part of the reason, too, why I did the works in progress, right? Because if you read it and then it expands in your mind and you're like, hey, Aaron, what if you did this? I know that that's a good direction to go because people are interested in it enough that it is taking root in their brains, you know?
Yeah. Well said. That's a beautiful quote, by the way. Well, thank you so much, Aaron, for taking the time to speak with us. It was so much fun. And since we mentioned your website, do you think you can tell what the address is for our listeners who want to check it out?
Yes, it's Aaron B, as in Baldwin, writes.com.
Awesome.
All right.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
And that was Aaron. Her novel, Good Luck Babe, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Bubble online bookstore. So if you enjoyed our conversation with Aaron and want to check out her new book, you can do so. You can pick up a copy by going to booksandbubble.com and check out our bookshop link. As always, all purchases made on our online bookstore support not only us here at Books and Bubble, but also your local bookstore. So, you know, doing good with some good. And before we call an episode, just a quick reminder that our August 2026 Books and Boba Book Club pick is Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro, which is the Nobel Prize winning author's latest novel about Clara, an artificial friend, and her journey to learn more about the world and humans. And this being an Ishiguro book, I'm sure we will all be in tears by the end of this reading. We're really excited to get into this book with you all, especially with the film version directed by Taika Waititi coming out later this year. This is the perfect chance to get caught up with the book before the film comes out. So as always, if you're part of our Patreon, we are reading along on Discord. So don't forget to check out the Discord channel for the reading schedule. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts. And as always, we'd love to include those thoughts in our discussion episodes whenever possible. And yeah, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Aaron Baldwin for joining us. And we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in Baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone. Especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallusbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.